Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Hello, everyone.
Hey.
How are
you
doing? Chapter 7. So we finished the basic construction of the Beis HaMikdash. And it was interesting that it took about 7 years. And now Shlomo HaMelech is going to build his own house. So the Beis HaMikdash was huge. It was on a much bigger scale than Shlomo's own house. So you would have expected that the Beis HaMikdash would take much longer than his own house would. Yet we're going to read right away that his own house, verse 1 in chapter 7, is based upon Shlomo Shlosh Asrei Shana, took 13 years. So why would that be? Why would something that's much bigger and much more complex would take much longer than his own house? The simple Chazal understood that when it came to the Beis HaMikdash, there was a mitzvah involved. And Shlomo HaMelech put all of his efforts into that building of the Beis HaMikdash. His father his whole life wanted to build the Beis HaMikdash. And finally the opportunity came, and 7 years is a long time to wait for a building. So he put that was important to him. So he put all of his efforts into building the Beis HaMikdash, whereas his own house, it wasn't that it was not important, but building takes a long time. It took him much longer to do that. It took him 13 years. So it's just interesting how that that his own house took him longer than the Beis HaMikdash, even though his own house was not anywhere near the project that, you didn't have 30,000 workers, working day and night for the construction of his own private house. The question is, why does it go into detail about his own house? This book was written hundreds of years later by the prophets, why would they go into even mentioning that Shlomo had his own house and where it was next to the Beis HaMikdash? So part of the idea was that the Jewish king was a partner, the monarchy was a partner with the Beis HaMikdash and the Kohanim and the Sanhedrin. Those were the three parts of the Jewish government. You had the king, you had the Sanhedrin, the court, and then you had the Beis HaMikdash with the Kohanim. And the three worked together. Some people say that the American government, where they made the Senate and the House and the Supreme Court, also had that in mind, like the triumvirate, is that what they call it, or to split the power and the. The Jewish people needs to have different to function as a nation. There are different things that need to happen. So you have to have spirituality, you have to have the closeness to Hashem, then you need justice, you need a court that functions, and you also need, in order to accomplish things, you need a king, you need a leader, you need somebody that's going to take care of the people, that's going to ensure that justice is done, ensure that the people follow in the ways of the Torah. And when the king does what he's supposed to, so then the other things work. Then the court works and the Beis HaMikdash works. But then when the king became corrupted or he wasn't interested in working very hard, so then the other things fell to the wayside. So what's hard for us as Americans were that America was founded on the fact that the monarchy didn't work. What was it, King...
George.
King George, that's right. With the Tea Party, the old Tea Party. Today you say Tea Party, they don't know what you're talking about. But the monarchy that we kind of came at the end of monarchies. They had maybe 50 years ago, Europe was full of monarchies. You had the Ottoman Empire, and you had the Kaiser, and you had the Tsar, and now they've all fallen down, and they've been discredited. What we find is that democracies aren't always ideal. They also become corrupted. There are a lot of European countries that have... they change governments every 6 months, and we see that Israel's had a hard time with democracies, and then dictators are horrible. Everybody looks at these terrible dictators. You just pay attention to the news, and government is not easy. it just isn't easy to have good government. And you know, in America, people are very common that we're not happy with our leaders and we're frustrated. And when you get a good leader, that's when everybody's happy. When you get a real, you know, somebody who you know, really cares about what they're doing and puts themselves into it. And then, so really, what the mold for the kings was the line of David, kings that followed after David, that dedicated their lives to their people. And so it kind of takes us, we just have to think about it a little different. In other words, David wasn't a person that wanted the honor. He wasn't a person that wanted the fame. He was a person that, again, we have the model of David, and we have also Shaul, and people that were just concerned about the Jewish people, that were worried about, you know, that we should be safe from our enemies, that there should be food to eat, that there should be justice for the poor and the downtrodden. And that was the hallmark of the Jewish monarch. And that's why it was next to the court of justice, because if you have a government and there's no justice, so forget about it. You know, then it's corrupt, then it's from the roots, it's no good. So it was very important that Shlomo built his house next to the court, because he wanted to show that the king, the king's not above the law, the king's a partner with the law. And when the king feels he's above the law, then you just have to look, you know, at the history of communism, which is interesting, that the original idea was that everybody was equal and that everybody would share and that it would be the wonderful, and it became corrupted so quickly. That it's an experiment that failed. So in the same leaders that were claiming that it was wrong to be, you know, to have wealth and to be, everybody was equal and everybody was comrade. And then before you knew it, you had the Communist Party, but some are more equal than others. And it's just so interesting that, you know, what we think would be easy is not really easy. And so the model was having the righteous kings and kings that were required to follow the laws and really were just a conduit for the real king, who was Hashem. I think I mentioned once that one of the things we say when we bless the new moon is David Melech Yisrael. That's one of the, and that's because the new moon, the moon is just a, it doesn't have its own light. It's just the light of the sun that it's reflecting. And so a king really doesn't have his... He sees himself as being given power by Hashem. As long as he realizes that it comes from Hashem, then he's okay. When a king thinks he's God, that's when you have trouble. And that's where, if we look in history, whether it was Paro or whether it was other people, when they thought that they were something, they didn't see it as a gift from Hashem to Hashem put them in this place to do whatever it was, that's when we had trouble. So it was important to set it up that way. And if you had your palace next to the courts and next to the Beis Hamikdash, it would give you pause what goes on in the palace, because you know you would just, the environments you were in. I was wondering myself, you know, I was trying to think, you know, later on we're going to see Shlomo had 1,000 wives. How do you build a palace for 1,000 wives? Like, who had 1,000 rooms? Like, you know, I don't even know how they. You know, I assume a princess needs to have her own room at least, or her own. We're going to see that some of his wives actually got their own palace. So it just the size, you know, the size of this was amazing, or hard to imagine. You know, that we really don't have anything left of the times of King Shlomo HaMelech. They found his stables. They know where the stables were. And I think I mentioned to you, they have some of the stones on the western wall, they believe were from the original stones from the first, because some of the stones are different than, they're quarried different than the Herodian stones. So they believe they're from the first temple. But other than that, we really don't have, you know, what we're going to learn about now doesn't, but it existed for hundreds of years. And they intended it to last. And they say that David, when he made a monarchy, intended it to be like a dynasty. He intended to set the tone of what the kings would look like. One thing that happened was that we'll see very quickly a group split off, and there developed another monarchy from the 10 tribes. And the other monarchy in a very short time got corrupted and started having assassinations, and they started having wars, and it got corrupted very quickly. And yet David's monarchy didn't. By and large, the kings from the house of David were righteous. It's like if a political party could figure out how to always have good candidates, you know, and have righteous candidates, then you've got it made. Like, in other words, even then you have free will. There were kings from the house of David. They did have a few rotten apples. There was Manasseh. There were others. But by and large, the majority of them were righteous kings and good leaders. So they did something right, although there was free will. So Shlomo was trying to set up the edifice that really his father had set up with the building of the Beis HaMikdash and the setting up of the nation to last. We'll see, even though he set it up to last, you know, under his son it fell apart, but the building stood for a long time. And so we're going to learn about the building. Unfortunately, I'm not into graphics that well, and I've looked at some of the pictures. We're going to describe some of the things that he built, and I don't really know what they look like. And I had one book of pictures at home, but then after looking at it, I decided it probably wasn't that accurate. And unfortunately, a lot of the pictures that are out there are not really accurate. They're more of like a visual. Somebody decides, oh, I think it looks like this. But it's not always built to scale. In recent times, they've come up with better computer programs for graphics. And they have different, you can watch where they show you the Beis HaMikdash and they show you other things. Some of them, they have a little bit of an idea, and some they don't. We're going to talk about this giant sea that Shlomo created, like a giant mikveh that he made. And we have no idea what it looked like, but we'll talk about it. I just wish I had all the answers. So we're going to read about the planks and the design and this and that, and feel free to pipe in. But I can't say that, you know, I thought about it. Maybe I'll start drawing up here and I'll say, I feel challenged with that. And then the deeper meaning of this chapter is a little bit hidden from me. We'll talk about some of the ideas, but some of these utensils and things that are here, we know if they were recorded, it's for a reason. Sometimes they hid in these chapters Kabbalistic ideas and other things. That's always true of different. I find that the older I get, I find that things that I discounted when I was young, I find that the hidden treasures are there. So we'll see a little bit of that as we go, but keep in mind, I really don't have all the answers about why it's recorded and what's the significance of it and what did it look like, but we'll get a basic idea of what was built here. Yeah.
Well, this book that's been out for a while called The Sanctuary that has the beautiful colored pictures in it, is that for Solomon's Temple? Is that or is that the Second Temple? Same thing about the city that we go to see.
That's the second temple. Yeah.
That's the second temple.
Yeah.
And the one that's called the sanctuary, it's a big black coffee table book, and it has pictures and pictures of the.
I think it's all the second temple.
The
pretty
second
sure.
Temple,
because Herod was the big builder. It was all Roman style, and a lot of the Roman construction is still around. So they're able to get a pretty good idea of what it looked like. Mm-hmm. But before King Solomon's time, I don't think there are any buildings left from maybe the Sphinx or something, but those aren't regular buildings. You know, it doesn't give us an idea of what the... So, you know, some of these things we just... later on, we're going to talk about his throne, and it was absolutely amazing what he did with his throne, and we have just nothing to compare it to, really.
All the building he did was destroyed by the Babylonians, or by...
And so I Googled K-N-O-P.
Okay. Oh, okay.
All right.
The knob.
Actually, what that is, it's a golden candelabrum or a candlestick. So if we look at the seven branches, I think they're supposed to represent the 7 days of the week, with the highest being
of creation.
And also I think it represents the head, like the eyes and everything that we're responsible in regard to the Torah. So if we get to nine branches, the shoulders would come in there that would shoulder the responsibility of the Torah. And then I started looking at cubits and converted that into feet. Mm-hmm. So with that 60, it became 90 feet. So then I looked to see possibly something in the gematria, which is the letter Samach, which I've got a note here, support, protection, and memory. connection with that.
So the word was, we saw the knobs, yeah, right? Uh-huh. And it means a candelabra top?
It's not, yeah, K-N-O-P is either Old and Middle English verbiage, and it refers to a golden candlestick.
Interesting.
And,
yeah.
it refers to the temple. You
know, it might be the knobs on the...
Well, I don't know if it was an actual knob.
Yeah, but see, but it was translated both ways. It says it refers to it both as knob and...
So it's the knob on the menorah is probably the design that we were talking about?
You're talking about the floral carving. See, and they refer to that also on the candlestick. There's floral carving.
Interesting. Wow. Okay. Thank you for the follow-up. All right. So as we started chapter 7, so it took him 30 years to build his house. And again, the rabbis praised him that he put the temple before his own house. And it was first he was going to take care of the country, then he would take care of himself. That's the ideal king, that he puts his country first. Okay. Verse 2, even at Beis Yarlona. And now he's going to build something called the Forest of Lebanon. Most people say this was his summer palace. And he gave it a name called the Forest of Lebanon. 100 by 50 by 30, Kamasal Arbature, with four rows of Amude Arozim, and Krusos of Arozim Alamudim. Now, they had giant lectures in these places where people came to learn about Judaism. People would come to the temple, and then they would come to Shlomo, and he would give lectures there about Torah and teach people the ways of Hashem. Lebanon sounds like a funny name. Why is it called the Forest of Lebanon? People talk about the value of a forest. We know today that, like, the rainforest is a life-giving, you know, the trees give off the oxygen and the air, and he wanted people to see that the Beis HaMikdash was like a forest, was like the source of life. We talk about there's significance that Adam was in a garden. You know, there's the Garden of Eden, and then there's a forest, and then there's we find ourselves in different environments of growth. And so he called this a forest. Now, the question is, Lebanon was a little bit more up north. That's where today's Lebanon is. We find that the Beis HaMikdash was called Lebanon. The word Lavan means to make white or to make clean. Mitlaben means the word Lavan means white in Hebrew. So it could be, the Beis HaMikdash was called Lavanon, to whiten, is that when a person sins, they make themselves dirty. They make their soul dirty. They've got a stain. They've got something. And they would go to the Beis HaMikdash, and they would walk away like they'd feel much lighter. They'd feel cleaned. And the symbolism was, they had, you know, we know in the Beis HaMikdash they had that crimson wool that would turn white at the end of Yom Kippur. And on Yom Kippur, we wear the white garments, and the Kohen Gadol wore the white garments to symbolize that we've made mistakes, and sometimes those mistakes drag us down, but we have the chance to start new and start fresh. And the Beis HaMikdash was that place that we'd go for a scrub. We'd go to get cleaned. And so it was called Lebanon, and so he called this the Forest of Lebanon.
Well, is cedar wood a light color when you...
That I don't know. I don't know if that...
If you look at houses that are built of cedar shingles, they are either gray or a light brown. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of houses in the Dunwoody neighborhood that are built of cedar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They're usually greenish now, today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they age.
Mm-hmm. Verse 3, Usaf and Be'erez from Allah, Slos, Eshel, Mudim, and they had the walls and the pillars. There were 45 different pillars and rows, Shkufim, and they had windows, Slos, Shetur, and the three rows, and Mechza, three times. The Kol HaPsachim, HaMezuzas, Revi'im, Shekef, and they had the posts and the windows. He's describing something here, and again, if I thought that we could get close to an accurate description, I would really try to do it, but it's challenging. You really need someone who's, you know, I guess, like, who can try to visualize it and put beams next to each other and try to see how it would look. Apparently that was important, how he made it. Otherwise, again, we don't have, there's a significance to dimensions, the amounts and the numbers and the That's Ulam Amudim Asa Chamishim Am Orchu Shloshim 50 by 30 Ba'uma Pneum, and there was an entrance room Ba'av Pneum, and there was a thick beam in front. You always find the entrance room. There's always this idea that you get ready before you walk in. You prepare yourself. We find in davening that there's a whole section of davening which is just we call Psukei Dezimra, which is like, gentlemen, you know, start your engines, you know, get ready, like, prepare. It's a you always find that you have, before you greet Hashem, if you focus for a minute, you prepare, you get ready, we take a step back. Why do we take a step back? Why don't we just start? We've been davening all day. No, you got to take a step back and try to focus your thoughts. So each place had this entrance room before you came in. Now we turn it into a coat room. You know, you kind of hang up your coat first. But a lot of places, well, Atlanta, you don't have a coat. Why do you need an entrance room? But it's just before you come, you just don't walk in. First, you have a room where you have a chance to think about. They quoted, there was a famous rabbi that before he'd get in his house, when he straightened out his tie, and he would, you know, and they'd say, why are you doing that? It's just your home. And he said, because I'm aware that before I come into a place, I have to think about how I'm going to act, and I want to make sure that I don't, you know, I say the right things to the right. If we'd all get ready, most of us know the right things to do. We're just not thinking about it. We don't prepare for it. And so if we prepare and say, well, you know, I'm coming home now, and you know, someone's been there who's had a hard day, maybe I want to say the right things, or somebody might need my help, or whatever it is. And so it's that moment of preparation that makes the difference. And so having an entrance room is a good idea. You think before you go and greet someone, you know, I have a minute to think about it. What am I going to say? What am I going to do?
In ancient times, one of the problems was windows. Because they didn't, if you had too many windows, the walls would fall down.
Really? Because of the support?
Or the walls wouldn't support the ceiling. Mm. So I just wonder, sometimes when there's so much emphasis on the windows, that I'm sure there are mystical meanings, but a practical aspect is that his brilliance was such that he could design a building with a lot of windows. They either had to be buttressed from the outside, mm-hmm. even in the Middle Ages, the cathedrals had that problem, and they have these buttresses on the outside. Because with those great big windows, especially of glass, they'd fall down. Mm-hmm. They needed support. So it's all here about the posts mm-hmm. and the windows.
I see. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you think about it, you go into Europe, it's a bunch of castles, and they're all dingy, and there's no air, they didn't know how to do it.
They couldn't figure out how to make too many openings in the wall.
Mm. So it's probably, that's true. Seventh, Ula Kisa Shayishkotsha. Now, he had a judgment room. In other words, there was a room where he stood on the throne, where people could come and he would, they would have justice, or they'd have somebody they could go to if there was a problem or if they felt they were being oppressed. They could go, and Shlomo was there. And it was from one side to the other. Now eight ubei. So that was this was like the room where he would do his business. In other words, the business of running the country. Besides that, he had his private house. Now it mentions that he made a special palace for the daughter of Paro. It seems like some people say that she was his favorite princess. Otherwise, why does it mention her? I mean, why did she get a palace? What about all the other 999? Some people say that Egypt was the primary country. If you look in the Middle East, it was the cradle of civilization, Egypt at that time, and Alexandria, and the even at the time of the Rambam, which was about 1,000 years later, Egypt was the. We're used to Europe being the part of the problem for the Muslims is that they've stagnated. In other words, they're not 2,000 years ago they were at their height, and now they're just not what they once were as far as culture and advances in mathematics and all kinds of sciences and areas to contribute to mankind. They passed their glory. And so, but Egypt was like that too. At one time, they were the cradle of the civilization where people from all over the world came. And so the fact that Egypt wanted to have an alliance with Shlomo, that Egypt was willing to give their daughter to be a princess, that meant this was like a world treaty that would bring the teachings of Hashem to the whole world. And Egypt represented Africa. It was really that whole, you know, that whole civilization there. And so Shlomo was very proud of his daughter that was his wife, that was the daughter of Paro. We mentioned before that there's no shortage of people that were willing to criticize Shlomo for it, you know, this daughter of Paro. We don't know personally whether she was, what the story was, but he did build her a separate palace.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, later on, the Hebrews are severely chastised for their alliance with Egypt. It's mm-hmm. happened several times in the time of...
Shlomo was trying to be the Mashiach, though. He was trying to influence them and teach them. It wasn't just an alliance like a treaty he was trying to reach them that way. Other people say he kept her in a separate house. You know, that meant that he didn't want her around too much, you know, if you build it. It wasn't his house. He had his house, and she had her, you know, separate bedroom. This is a separate palace. So it was like, you know, he set her up there, she'll be happy, and people could come visit her. But it was, again, so hard to know how those things existed in those times. Okay. It's well known that it's expensive to have queens and princesses, and, you know, this was a big undertaking. The Kalela Vanimikar, these were like very big stones, Kamidas Guzis, and they were hewn stones. The stones had to be quarried and dragged down from huge distances, and they didn't have the trucking, you know, that we have. They had to be, you know, really dragged by hand. It was a big thing. And they were from inside and outside, until the big courtyard, verse 10 of Yusuf Avanimikaris. And they set up these big, expensive stones. Some of them were more like gems that they used. Avanim Gedola, they were big. 10 amas, 10 cubits is like 15 feet. It's a pretty big stone. Avnei Shmona, 8 amas, Mamala, Avanim Yikaris, Kamidas Gozis, Feres, in the same size. And then the 12, Achatzah Gedola, then they had this big courtyard. Shlosh Turim, Gozis, Vitur, Krusos, Arazim. I was hoping somebody would have some pictures, but like I said, the pictures I found were very primitive, nothing like little sketches, nothing really significant. You'll find more on the temple itself than you will on the palaces. But you're probably right. The secrets of how to build, you know, if we had a good idea of how he did it, I'm sure it would be amazing. But Ulam Abayis, 13. Misha Kamel Shlomo. Now, interesting thing happens here. Some great people have trouble designating or finding good people to work for them. We often see this, that David had plenty of people that he brought into the government and worked for him, and Shlomo did as well. So Shlomo realized that all this building, he would require a good builder. He needed somebody who would be a good craftsman. And so he sends out, he sends people to look for the right kind of person. And he picked somebody whose name was Hiram, and he was from Sur. Now, the funny thing was, we had a king who was named Hiram. Mm-hmm. Almost everybody says that he wouldn't hire the king as a coppersmith. That doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. It's just a coincidence that he had the same name. Mm-hmm. Now, we know there's no such thing as a coincidence, but I don't know how to resolve that. In other words, there was another Hiram. Maybe Hiram was like a popular name at that time. You know, maybe that was like John Smith. I don't know. There's a guy named Hiram. I don't think we use that today, Hiram, too much. Hiram. This is a Jewish Hiram. Now, a few things. First of all, Ben Ish Almana. We find out about his mother. So it's interesting also. We always, one of the things we mentioned is typically when it mentions the mother, that means the mother made the man. You know, the mother made him into what he was. Here he was the son of a widow. And he was from the tribe of Naphtali, Ba'aviv Ish Tzorichoshi. Now, his father was a coppersmith. Now, if his mother was a widow, that means the father had passed away. Why do we need to know what his father did? So, in those days, people took great pride in having a family profession. And they passed down the secrets of that profession. They were people that for generations were goldsmiths or coppersmiths or worked in a certain line. And they took pride in that. In other words, their family developed the whatever that profession was, and it got passed down to their children to work in that way. We'll find other examples. There was a certain family that was specialized in spices, that knew how to make the incense. That they knew how to compound it. This was their. There was another family that were bakers that knew how to pass down baking traditions. And we find this like certain every chef and every baker, they have their certain secrets, and they don't necessarily share it with everybody. But to their family, they share it with, and they pass down this. You know that someone has that recipe or that. There's something special to be said for that. When a person's forefathers have worked in a certain area and developed certain skills and given that over, there's something unique to that. I think we've lost that to some degree in America. It's rare to find, where people in a family have done something very well and then passed it down to their children, and the children continue and are just known as having... The only one that came to mind is Chicago Mayor Daley, you know. He got it to... That's so funny.
The Ford family.
The Kennedys, but it's also not a good example.
The Feldmans.
The Feldmans, right. I was going to say the Bushes, you know. But it's not exactly the same. And there, each one is very different than the parent or the... The rabbi, some people had a tradition of being rabbis where they passed that down in the family, you know. But it's every now and then we'll run across some family where they did manage to pass the way, the unique way, the style and the experience of that family down to their children. And then when you go to such an establishment or you deal with them, you feel it's special because it's not just something that they tried. It's part of what their family has excelled in and been able to offer for many generations. And so that...
There's so much individual opportunity these days that someone could easily not inherit anything. But then it was a great thing, I guess, if you had a profession that you could really...
My mother always wanted all one of us to do what my father did, you know, like, or get the family, you know, somehow that was in her mind. But everybody has to do their own thing. That's the way, you know, it's very rare to have somebody that says, well, this is my family inheritance, so I want to do it because that's what my family does or stands for. Some of it we can blame on the exile. In other words, we've been moving around so much, so it's not like we've been in one area or one place for many, many generations where a family's able to develop some, being well known for certain things or passing it down. But Shlomo found somebody who had a tradition for working in copper. And that's a skill to be a good copper. I think a coppersmith, is that what they would call it? I guess it's a good coppersmith. And it says an interesting thing here. It says, "Vayimale es chokma v'setuna v'sedas," and he was full of chokma, tuna, and das. Chokma, chabad is chokma bina das. There's three kinds. There's different kinds of wisdom. There's like wisdom and intuition and skill, and sometimes you have to have knowledge, but then knowledge won't do it all. You have to have bina. Bina is able to put the two things together. Now, the word bina means nibona, to build. And that means that sometimes knowledge means you know from the information available to you, you have that. But bina means that you can take A and B and put it together to come up with C. And then das means more like what we call seichel, sometimes it on paper it might work, but it's not going to work in reality. Or you need to. So these were building projects that had never been done. They were constructing things that had never, you know, people do private little jewelry, but these were things, huge, you know, amounts of gold and silver and copper for the nation. And you really had to try to figure out exactly how much the metal would take and how long to cook it and what to do. And you needed somebody that just had the wisdom to do it and to do it wisely. And so it expresses that. He was full with these kind of wisdom. It's an interesting expression. The Torah uses this also when it describes the builder of the tabernacle by Bezalel. Mm-hmm. It says also he was full. I guess occasionally you'll meet a person who you feel is like just full of, you know, knows how to do it all. he's just full of whatever needs to, you'll come to something that's never been done and he knows how to do it. There's a certain knack that people have. It's almost like a sixth sense, you know. How do you know how to do this? And when you think about it, you know, building, there's so many different skill sets that they need. Yet the average builder, it's almost like a chef, you know, they somehow are capable of doing many different kinds of, you know, they can cut the tile and they can do the blowtorch and they can do wisdom. So they filled the Yavel, Melech Shlomo, so they brought him to King Shlomo, yes, it's called Malachto, and he did it all. He did his job. It's interesting, what's a good worker? He does his work. He does it all. He doesn't, you know, a lot of times you get contractors, they leave off things, you know, he leaves over. He did the Yas Eskol Malachto. He did it all. He did all of his work. One of the things they point out is that he was from the tribe of Naphtali, which was not the highest tribe. In other words, you know, Yehuda was like the, you know, the real fancy tribe. He was the king tribe. That was all the aristocrats. And Naphtali, and this was, in a way, a model in the Beis HaMikdash also, that the Beis HaMikdash, we find that it wasn't just for aristocrats, but specifically somebody, a simple person also, could be the one who would be the architect. You have to have both. You have to have representation from different areas if you want them. Today, it's not multiculturalism, but it's where, in the schools, they want people from different backgrounds that they feel that the educational environment is best served if you have, you know, people from the all different parts of society. So in a way, that's what Shlomo wanted to do. He got a person from Naphtali to be his builder. Okay, 15. Now he built two big copper pillars. See if they had, I didn't have this plan, but this will work. Every tomorrow or Tama, they have like the two pillars. They always show the. But this is just a guess of what the pillars look like. I think in a Gemara they have a different. Every artist is a little different on the pillars. Before they entered the Beit HaMikdash, a person came across these two pillars that he built. Let me see. I think. Excuse me.
I have a Gemara here.
Well, this is also kind of like two pillars that have them. But the artist, there's no longer a tradition exactly what the pillars like. But there's an idea that before you came to the temple, you had these two pillars, these two. I don't know, it doesn't seem like, I'm not sure if they held up anything or they were like a tapestry or the, he built these two big copper pillars.
When he's building the temple, everything's overlaid with gold.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that he like steps down, everything's overlaid with copper.
Mm-hmm. That's for his private house, you mean, or the, right, that's right. For Hashem, it's pure gold. For his private, that was, you know, copper would do. I don't know if gold looks nice, but I don't know if it's sturdy or if it's actually a useful metal or not, or too soft. If it's, yeah.
It was more like overlaid over.
I think so. I think it's more of an overlay to the wood. So these two pillars that he built are 18 amas. Chai Amos, 18, right? Life Amos, Thomas Amos, Echav, Chuchnei, Masri Amos, Yusuf Amos, Hasheni. And there was another, he says a line of 12 cubits, Ushtei Kisras Asra. And then he calls this a chapter. I don't know what that is. Hebrew is more like a crown. A Keser is more like a crown. In other words, on top of the. This is a crown, you know, and on top of the pillar was a crown or something on top. What do you use translate call that word? Chapters?
Capitals.
Capitals?
Yeah.
What's a capital?
Maybe so, yeah. It's the
top. The top. It's a
column.
It's what? Pommel.
P-O-M-E-L of apple-shaped knobs.
It was the top. The top of the pillar had like a magnificent top. Asalosis arosha mudin mutzak is made of copper, chamish amas chamas kasoros, echav chamish amas chamas. It was 5 by 5 cubits, the height of the other one, 17. Now, then they had, coming from them, they had shavakim maasei shovacha. He calls this checker work.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's these were copper-like different. The way I viewed it was like copper threads, like a netting kind of thing. But I don't have the maisha shir that went from one crown to the other. Shivlik had said there were 7 to 1 and 7 to the next. 18.
Where were they?
On the entranceway when you came into the building.
No. The nettings were.
Oh. I don't know.
Were they on top of the pillars?
I believe they were on top. Yeah. Again, this isn't. This is just a like an. Over the years, they try to. These are two pillars, and these are nettings, and. But I don't think this was meant to be an.
They were designed like meshwork.
They just. So they connected one pillar to the other. Is that?
I guess so. I think this was meant for beauty or for style. 18. But yes, it's a Mudim Mishnei Turim Sevim. And they made the pillars and the areas around them, Asher Akos HaKatsu, to cover they had an area on top to cover Asher Rosh HaRimonim. And one had the pomegranates. Pomegranates were always a sign of fruitful, and they decorated with pomegranates. That's why we decorate the sukkah with pomegranates. It was always considered one of the more beautiful fruits. We have the sometimes the Torahs have the on the crowns they have the little pomegranates hanging there, or the kenaf. So they also had these pomegranates hanging from the other one. 19. Ksaros Asher Rosh Amudin Maaseh Shushan. It was, he called this the lily work. It meant it was like flower-like. Again, it was in the picture. Bula Barba, it was 4 amas. They went from one pillar to the other. With the pomegranates, there were 200. Sabi Valkasar Sashenis from the second one, 21. Yachvas Amudim Le'ulam, and they set these up on the entranceway. In other words, before you came into the building. The reason they put this on the page before every page of Talmud is, it's like when you're about to enter, you hit the pillars first. So you're about to enter the book. This is the pre-page, so somebody put the idea to put the pillars. So he put up the two, and he gave each pillar a name. V'yichu eshmo Yachin, one of them he called Yachin, on verse 21. V'yachim es amud asmo, on the left one was called Boaz. There's a famous commentary to the Mishnayos. The Mishnayos are the oral law. And it's called Yochanan and Boaz. He chose the names of the two pillars. What's the significance of these names? So now here we have to put on our thinking caps a little bit here. So Yochanan, what does the word Yochanan mean? So usually Yochanan means to comes from the word hachana, which means to prepare. And so it could mean like prepare, like to get ready, or. And then the word Boaz means comes strength. Get ready to strengthen yourself or to be re-strengthened, it could be. Some people learn them as like a positive and a negative, like they learn it differently. He doesn't translate. The English here cups out on the Yochanan and Boaz. He doesn't even try. It just says Jachin and Boaz. But there was a significance to each name. Some people say it was like the positive mitzvahs and the negative mitzvahs. Those are the two pillars that. Whereas on life, we have two aspects of our being a Jew. There are the things that we got to do and the things that we better not do. Those are the two. As long as we stick to both, then we will be all right.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.